This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the editor and essayist Nicholas Del Banco, speaking with us today about the art of old age. Your new book, Nicholas, comes with the title Lastingness, and in it you ask why creative artists, writers and musicians, as well as painters and sculptors, continue to produce masterpieces well into their 70s and 80s. Do you find some sort of connection between a long life and a creative mind?
Well, the first thing to say is that it's a relatively new question. There were always statistical outliers. Sophocles is supposed to have lived into his 90s. Titian certainly did, Michelangelo, etc. But by and large, we as a species are growing grayer and living longer. And so I found myself contemplating what it means to be an artist in the 70s, 80s, and 90s in a sense that really was only rarely asked, I think, in previous centuries. Even our great old experts on old age, such as Shakespeare, made it to his mid or early 50s. Keats never made it past 25, etc. But now we're finding more and more of us are in what I suppose is technically still described the twilight or the sunset years. And I found myself wondering what it took to keep on keeping on.
And you have many examples to draw from, most of them within the last 20 years. I mean, you go through Thomas Hardy, Henry Moore, George Sand, Pablo Casals, George O'Keefe, William Yeats. I mean, it's a long list. But choose one or two of these figures in whom you find something of the secret.
Well, I think Yeats is probably the exemplary instance of a writer who improved with age. Had he died at the age of 40 or even a little later, he'd probably be a minor presence in the history of English verse. Much, if not most, of his great work was produced towards the end of his life. And he said, or wrote brilliantly in that famous pivotal poem of his, Sailing to Byzantium, "An aged man is but a paltry thing, tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress." And though I don't think we want to be compared to scarecrows all that often, or find it comfortable to acknowledge that age brings tatters, Yeats took great advantage of that diminution and made his soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing, right up to the very end. And this tends to be true of the many figures I portrayed. I took the three forms of artistic expression with which I have any familiarity, writing, painting, and music, and focused on folk who at least maintained and in some cases advanced their art, as I think he did, past the age of 70.
You have a fine quote from Pablo Casals, a cellist, who says, he makes a speech in Central Park in 1973, and he says, "I am perhaps the oldest musician in the world. I am an old man, but in many senses I am a very young man." Which is like Yeats saying that he's an old man, but he has a young muse.
I think that's exactly right. And he said something else, which I'll shamelessly quote to you. "My work is my life. I cannot think of one without the other. To retire means to begin to die. The man who works and is never bored is never old. Work and interest are the best remedy for age. Each day I am reborn. Each day I must begin again." Casals is actually a particularly interesting figure in this regard because he was, I mean, Yeats was a very successful young poet and a celebrated one, but, you know, he was still part of a large group of hopefuls. Casals was a prodigious cellist and a great virtuoso and recognized with a large concert career, even in his teens and certainly in his 20s. But then he came up against history. As you know, of course, he was in absolute opposition to Generalissimo Franco and Hitler in the Spanish Civil War and then the Second World War. And he simply withdrew from the concert stage. I mean, for many years, he refused. And in fact, at some personal peril, because Franco and Hitler wanted him to play for them, he refused to perform. He retired to the hilltop village of Prad in the Pyrenees, and as he said to someone once, his career was made more important by the things he refused to do than that which he did. And so he lost a little bit in a totally separate context, the way Ted Williams lost the chance to hit another 50 home runs by volunteering for the Air Force. He lost some of his agility with the instrument as such, and towards the end of his life really could not play the cello except for private pleasure. It's not a forgiving instrument, unlike the piano, which produces its own sound. The cello requires muscularity and agility and so on and so forth. And in the end, he became what he had always also wanted to be, a composer, a conductor, and very much of an ambassador for the world of music. So he replenished what were diminishing springs, as it were, with another form of his life force, his vital force, and he did that right up until the very end.
Is there such a thing as a late style? In other words, does great art made in the latter years of life have certain characteristics that you can find common to music as well as painting and writing?
That is, of course, the crucial question, and one that it's difficult to answer. I found that there was no single one-size-fits-all version of late style, though there are certain common characteristics, I think. And one of them, by the way, has to do with what I was just discussing, the notion of diminished physical agility. Monet, for instance, who's another one of the artists on whom I focus, was more or less legally and technically blind towards the end. And what happened when he began to make that series of masterpieces, which we know as the Nymphaeas, the water lilies and the irises, in his farmhouse in Giverny, is that he had to see things in a different way. Another image for me that remains very strong is that of the arthritic, the crippled Pierre Renoir, who actually had to have a paintbrush more or less strapped to, wedged between his fingers so that he could continue to daub at the canvas. So the elderly artist does not necessarily deny physical bodily decrepitude, as it were, but makes of it, as Yeats again said, wisdom. His great phrase, bodily decrepitude is wisdom. And I think, to come a long way around to trying to answer your question, that this sort of renewed focus, this diminished span, but this depth perception, if you will, is something that crosses the genres that I discuss. There's less showiness and more shown.
And also, I mean, I find other common themes in your various figures, a certain kind of compression or simplicity and a taking of the ego out of it, and more of a freedom to adventure.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the young artist, certainly true of this young artist, is full of the desire to make an impression on and in the world and to assert the ego. But particularly if you've had some degree of success at that, and certainly if you've done it for a very long time, it begins to be both less necessary and less attractive, so that the artist becomes more and more an instrument by which a time and place makes its mark, not the person who tries to make his mark upon that time and place. So to transmit more is incrementally, I think, the aspiration of the folk that I wrote about. They were less egotistical, even if they were more inward focused.
You say at the beginning, you have a couple of maxims, and one of them is to stay alive and stay awake are not always one and the same. So maybe you could comment on that by using the idea of creativity, not just with great artists, but with business tycoons or people who have passionate hobbies, to keep the mind alive.
I think that's very much the case, and it is another one of those common skeins or denominators I found myself naming both at book's beginning and with a sense of ratification at book's end. It's to stay interested. That's the really difficult charge of increasing age. I mean, when I was young, every day brought with it the promise of something or someone not known before, and now there's very little that's new under the fictive sun. So to stay alive and to stay interested is often one and the same, and I suppose I could use the contrary or the negative example of those elders we see with something like horror, who sit all day in the one chair and stare blinkingly at the wall. That's what one has to avoid, and I think the way to do so is precisely to remain passionate, whether it be about some charity work, some golf swing, some aspect of one's grandchildren, whatever. I do think think those elders of the tribe who retain their passionate interest are the ones we must admire.
That goes along with a very old ideal many, many, many centuries ago, that the late years were associated not with dying, but with vitality and character. The old is venerable and repositories of custom, legend, wisdom.
That's correct. And I think somehow, we lost that notion in America. It is, as you of course know, a culture that celebrates youth, that looks for the next new thing, not the continuity of what was here before. And we really have turned away from the idea that our elders are our betters. Probably that has to be revisited, if only because some sense of the long reach of the history and tradition of a culture is crucial to its maintenance. My best guess, or at least my best hope, is that as our population ages, we will kind of redress that a little bit. It really is hard for me, at least, to accept that our teenagers should be the ones who are setting the cultural norm.
In a way, you can say that age, if properly approached and ventured upon, is indeed the fountain of youth.
Nicely put. Again, to go back to Yeats, he had a wonderful quatrain, which, because it's only four lines long, I can recite to you in its entirety. You think it horrible that lust and rage should dance attention upon my old age. They were not such a plague when I was young. What else have I to spur me into song? So I'm not suggesting, and he certainly wasn't, that the elder of the tribe need to sit and dodder by the fire and wag his or her venerable white head. There can be a lot of passionate intensity, a lot of engaged rage and lust even. But that's not the same thing as saying that it's a first time through not drinking from that fountain of youth.
On that hopeful note, thank you, Nicholas Del Banco, for speaking with us today about the art of old age. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly from Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.